Welcome to the Universal Podcast Network. One voice, everywhere.
Hi, I'm Daniel Kiz.
And this is Mick, the Doctor of Digital.
And welcome to Music 101, where sound, story, and history come together to shape the music we know today. Another week, another great episode, definitely. And, well, Alchemist of Rock, the greatest backing bands of the 1960s and the 70s, part two.
Yes, indeed. So as we saw in part one, every era has its myths of the lone genius, the solitary figure at the microphone, the master guitarist alone in the spotlight, the songwriter who changed the world one chord at a time. But rock and roll, at its most elemental, has always been a team sport. Behind every iconic frontman or woman who defined the sonic landscape of the 1960s and 70s stands a constellation of musicians, sometimes unnamed, sometimes undersung, often misunderstood, whose collective intelligence shaped the very recordings we hold sacred. In conclusion, this episode of Music 101 pulls back the curtain on that hidden architecture, the famous backing bands who didn't just support the stars they played beside, but in many cases became the stars, transforming raw talent into something lasting, luminous, and almost impossibly great.
Indeed, impossibly great. So, Mr. Mick, there's a fascinating philosophical question that runs through all of these stories. At what point does backing band stop being backing band and become something else? And I think one of the most dramatic examples of the question is Derek and the Dominoes.
Eric Clapton's decision to form Derek and the Dominoes in the 1970s was, at one level, an attempt to escape his own celebrity, to step back from the burden of being the guy who people said about him, Clapton is God, and play music in a group context where he wasn't automatically the main attraction. When I was in high school, my buddies and I loved his music with John Mayall and the Blues Breakers, and then he played with Blind Faith, which was another supergroup exercise and found it constraining. What he wanted was the feeling of being one musician among equals, of playing with rather than performing to. The four musicians who became the Dominoes, Clapton on guitar and vocals, Bobby Whitlock on keyboards and vocals, Carl Radel on bass, and Jim Gordon on drums, had all previously played together in the backing band for Delaney and Bonnie, so they had an existing musical vocabulary. Clapton arrived at the sessions with songs about his secret love for Patty Boyd, George Harrison's wife, an unrequited passion that had been consuming him for years, and the band arrived with the willingness to turn those feelings into music. And the album they made, Layla and Other Assorted Love Songs, became one of the most celebrated in rock history. It did eventually, though its a commercial reception at the time of release in November 1970 was tepid at best. The album didn't chart at all in the UK, partly because Clapton had deliberately obscured his own participation. His name appeared only on the back cover, in small type. He wanted to be Derek, not Eric. The transformation of the record from relative obscurity to legendary status took several years and was accelerated by the 1972 re-release of Layla as a single in full length, which reached the top 10 on both sides of the Atlantic. The story of Duane Allman's involvement in the recording sessions is one of the great rock and roll serendipity stories. The Dominoes recording at Criteria Studios in Miami in August 1970 with producer Tom Dowd. Dowd was simultaneously producing Idlewild South, the second album by the Allman Brothers Band, at the same studio. He took Clapton to see the Allman Brothers perform benefit concert on August 26. Clapton had been a fan of Duane Allman's slide guitar work. He had heard it play on Wilson Pickett's extraordinary soul cover of Hey Jude, but had never seen him play live. When Allman turned around during a guitar solo and saw Clapton sitting in the front row, he reportedly froze. After the show, both bands returned to Criteria and jammed through the night. The following morning, Clapton invited Allman to join the sessions. Allman played on 11 of the album's 14 tracks, fitting his contributions around his obligations to the Allman Brothers Band, who had their own touring schedule. Allman never toured with the Dominoes. He declined Clapton's invitation to join the band permanently, unwilling to leave his own group. But his presence on the record is definitive. Clapton later wrote that the two had been inseparable during the Miami sessions and described Allman as the musical brother I never had. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers represent a slightly different model, a band that was genuinely collaborative from the start, but the backing band framing was almost a fiction from day one. This is an important distinction, and it points to something real about how the category breaks down in certain cases. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers formed in Los Angeles in 1976 from the musicians Petty had known since his Florida days, and from early on, certainly by their debut album, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers in 1976, the band had a distinctive collective voice that couldn't be attributed to any single member. Mike Campbell's guitar work is as central to the Heartbreakers sound as Petty's songwriting. Campbell certainly had his own distinctive style, for example, collaborating with Ian Hunter on the song Dirty Job. Ben Montench's keyboard playing, understated, melodically inventive, rooted in American folk and rock tradition, gave the band its harmonic intelligence. American Girl is the prototype, a perfect rock song built from simple materials, a jangly guitar figure influenced partly by Roger McGuinn's Rickenbacker work with the Byrds, in which every element of the band's contribution is audible and essential. And yet, Petty retained the naming convention, and the Heartbreakers were never separately famous. It speaks to the asymmetries that's almost always present in the frontman and band relationship, however creative the dynamic. The frontman is the face, the commercial anchor, the name on the marquee. The band members are, legally and commercially, employees of the enterprise, even when, musically, they are equals. This created real tensions in various configurations we've discussed. Levon Helm's resentment that Robbie Robertson received primary songwriting credit for the band's material was documented and deeply felt. The rumor chafed at being perceived only as Graham Parker's backing band, eventually recording three albums of their own. The Spiders from Mars were reportedly devastated when Bowie retired the Ziggy persona without warning at Hammersmith. It was, for Boulder and Woodmansey, the end of the biggest thing they would ever be a part of, announced from the stage before they had been told privately. Oh well, these stories abound, like the sacking of Pete Best by Brian Epstein, the Beatles' manager, while the other Beatles skulk behind Pete's back. We've talked about backing bands that were essentially found or assembled by a solo artist, but what about the bands that grew up together, the ones where the DNA of the frontman and the musicians is virtually indistinguishable? You're talking about the Heartbreakers, and specifically you're talking about the transition from a scruffy Gainesville, Florida outfit called Mud Crunch into the lean, lethal machine that backed Tom Petty starting in 1976. What makes the Heartbreakers the gold standard of backing bands is they never sounded like they were following Petty. They sounded like they were breathing with him. It started with that debut self-titled album in 76. But the world didn't catch on immediately. In fact, Breakdown didn't even chart in the U.S. until nearly a year after its release. But listen to that track. It's a masterclass in space. Most young bands in 1976 were trying to play as fast or as loud as possible. The Heartbreakers did the opposite. Ben Montench's snake-like electric piano and Mike Campbell's minimalist guitar licks created a noir atmosphere that gave Petty's drawl a sense of dangerous cool. Mike Campbell is often cited as the secret weapon of that band. He is the ultimate player for the song. He never played a note that didn't serve the lyric. In an era of guitar heroes who wanted a solo for 10 minutes, Campbell would give you a four-bar hook that you'd remember for 40 years. Think of the descending riff in American Girl. It's propulsive, it's cinematic, and it perfectly captures the wide-open road energy of Petty's writing. And then there was this tension. I've read that the sessions for Damn the Torpedoes in 1975 were incredibly grueling. Petty was in a legal war with his label, and the band was holed up in Sound City Studios with producer Jimmy Iovine, who was obsessed with getting the perfect drum sound. They played Refugee over 100 times. Stan Lynch, the drummer, almost quit, but that tension resulted in what many consider the definitive rock album of the late 70s. The Heartbreakers provided a big sound that still felt intimate. They were the bridge between the grit of the 60s and the polished stadium rock of the 80s. Petty went solo for Full Moon Fever in 1989. The band could field sideline, and there certainly was some friction, but even on his solo records, Mike Campbell was usually right there co-writing and playing. It proved that while Petty was the face and the voice, the Heartbreakers were the essential nervous system. Without Fenmont's Hammond B3 organ swells or the locked-in rhythm section of Ron Blair and Stan Lynch, a Tom Petty song just didn't have the same weight. They were a democracy led by a benevolent dictator, and that balance is what kept them together for 40 years until Tom's passing in 2017. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers remind us that the best backing bands aren't just a support system, they are a signature. In conclusion, they provide the texture and reliability that allow a frontman to take risks, knowing that the foundation beneath them is unbreakable. In conclusion, the tension between artistic equality and commercial hierarchy is the defining existential condition of the backing band, an arrangement that enables greatness while sometimes denying the people who create that greatness the full measure of recognition they deserve.
Mr. Mick, we talk a great deal about backing bands in a studio context, but several of the most important configuration we have yet covered, we define primarily by their live performances.
And that's a crucial corrective, because the live context is where certain backing band relationships show their fullest dimension. Van Morris is an interesting figure in this regard, someone who has worked with an extraordinary variety of musicians over the decades, but whose most celebrated live band was the Caledonia Soul Orchestra, which he assembled for the 1974 live double album, It's Too Late to Stop Now, widely considered one of the greatest live albums ever recorded. The Caledonia Soul Orchestra was special because everything about the configuration was designed to serve Morrison's improvisatory soul performances. The band included not just a standard rock rhythm and guitars, but a string section, a horn section, and a remarkable collection of individual players, including guitarist John Plantea and saxophonist Jack Shore, who had the rare ability to follow Morrison through his extended musical explorations without ever losing him. Morrison, at his best, is a performer who treats a song not as a fixed text, but as a departure point, a gate through which he walks into something unmapped. And the Caledonia Soul Orchestra understood this in their bones. The version of Listen to the Lion that appears on It's Too Late to Stop Now is a sustained musical ecstasy, a performance in which Morrison's voice does things for which there is no adequate critical vocabulary, and the band follows him into every corner of it without ever crowding the space. Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band represent a very different live tradition. The Silver Bullet Band was assembled by Seger in 1974 from Detroit area musicians, and it became a vehicle through which Seger finally broke through nationally after years of regional success. The core of the band, guitarist Drew Abbott, saxophonist Alton Reed, bassist Chris Campbell, keyboardist Greg Frost, was built for endurance. Two-hour live shows of blue-collar rock that drew on the same Midwestern working-class audience that would later embrace Springsteen, but with a distinctly Detroit edge. Night Moves from the 1976 album Night Moves showed the band at their most controlled and reflective, a song about the specific nostalgia of adolescence in a small American town. With a piano figure and an almost country folk guitar arrangement that provided a different dimension from Seger's harder driving live work. Let's also acknowledge a few of the more unusual backing band relationships on our list. Sly and the Family Stone and Captain Beefheart's Magic Band. These are fascinating cases because they sit at the extreme ends of the spectrum. Sly and the Family Stone was technically not a backing band in any conventional sense. It was an integrated group, one of the many racially and gender integrated American rock bands, in which Sly Stone was the creative engine. But Freddie Stone, Rose Stone, Cynthia Robinson, Larry Graham, Jerry Martini, and Greg Errico were genuine co-performers with distinct public identities. Thank you for letting me be myself again. It's one of the great rhythm and groove records in American music. And Larry Graham's slapping bass technique on this and other tracks essentially invented the vocabulary that would dominate funk and soul bass playing for the next 50 years. Every funk and R&B bassist who came after Graham, including, by his own admission, Marcus Miller, Stanley Clark, and others, built on what Graham developed within the Family Stone. And Captain Beefheart's Magic Band is perhaps the strangest case in our entire discussion, because their relationship to conventional notions of musical accompaniment was essentially adversarial. Don Von Fleet, Captain Beefheart, conceived music through an extremely unorthodox process that involved dictating parts, often by humming or playing piano, to musicians who then had to transcribe and learn extraordinarily complex polyphonic figures. the Trout Mask Replica album of 1969, recorded with the Magic Band, whose members included guitarist Zoot Horn Rollo and Rockette Morton. Drummer John Drumbo French and bassist The Mascara Snake is often described as one of the most challenging, dissonant, and musically unprecedented recordings ever made in a rock context. French has written extensively about the grueling conditions under which the band rehearsed, sometimes for months in near isolation, to produce music that sounds almost anarchically spontaneous, but is in fact precisely notated and fiendishly difficult to execute. Big-Eyed Beans from Venus, from the 1972 album Clear Spot, shows the Magic Band in a slightly more accessible mode, but it still sounds like nothing else ever recorded, a kind of avant-garde Delta blues that could only exist in the collision between Beefheart's singular vision and musicians trained painfully to execute it. In conclusion, the range of configurations represented by Morrison's Caledonia Soul Orchestra, Seeger's Silver Bullet Band, The Family Stone, and The Magic Band reveals that the backing band concept encompasses everything from the most organic collective improvisation to the most rigidly hierarchical musical dictatorship, and that greatness can emerge from any point along that spectrum.
Mr. Mick, to close out our survey, let's look at the two more configurations that illustrate the range of what backing band's relationship can be: Eric Burdon and War, and Elvis Costello and The Attractions.
Both are remarkable stories. Eric Burdon first made his name in the mid-1960s as the ferocious lead voice of The Animals, one of the great British invasion bands, with one of the genuinely perfect rock singles in The House of the Rising Sun, which reached number one in both the UK and the US in 1964. But by the late 1960s, the original Animals had dissolved. Burdon had gone through various lineup changes, and he was looking for something new. In 1969, he encountered another multiracial band from Long Beach, California, called Night Shift, who were playing a fusion of funk, R&B, rock, Latin rhythms, and jazz that was entirely unlike anything happening in the rock mainstream. Burdon renamed them War and began recording and performing with them immediately. Their collaboration produced some extraordinary music, like Spill the Wine from 1970, which reached the top 10, a psychedelic funk piece with Burdon's spoken word narrative over War's elaborate instrumental backdrop. And The World is a Ghetto, which War recorded after Burdon departed, reached number one in 1973, demonstrating that War was never simply a backing band, but a fully formed musical entity in its own right, who happened to share a few fertile years with the great British vocalist. The Burdon-War partnership is a vivid example of what happened when a backing band's musical vocabulary is so strong that they transcend the category almost immediately. And Elvis Costello assembled The Attractions, keyboardist Steve Neave, bassist Bruce Thomas, and drummer Pete Thomas for his second album, This Year's Model, in 1978, and the combination was instantaneous chemistry. I had the occasion to see Elvis and the band at Millikan High School on their first U.S. tour. Their performance was held in the basketball gym as if it were a high school hop dance with canvas on the floor and everything. Costello had extraordinary songs, dense, literary, rhythmically alert, emotionally mercurial. The Attractions gave him a sound that was essentially alert. Neave's organ and piano playing, heavily influenced by the classical tradition, but deployed in a rock context with irreverent, almost manic energy. Bruce Thomas's melodically inventive bass playing, Pete Thomas's martial driving drums. The Attractions were, in Costello's own words, a band he was only slightly afraid of because they were all capable of taking any song somewhere he hadn't expected. I Don't Want to Go to Chelsea and Pump It Up from This Year's Model are among the most kinetically exciting rock recordings of the decade, performances in which the Attractions' collective charge amplifies Costello's writing to a nearly unbearable pitch of energy. There is a common thread that runs through all the backing bands we've discussed today, and it goes beyond the obvious. The great music requires great musicians. The deeper thread is about trust and specificity. Every one of the backing bands we've discussed was built, consciously or by accident, out of a very particular artistic chemistry. The band could translate Dylan's poetry into roots music because they had already lived inside America's roots, music history more deeply than most Americans. Crazy Horse could hold the space for Young's guitar meditations because they had a specific, almost Buddhist tolerance for duration and drone. The Spiders could embody Ziggy Stardust's theatricality because Ronson was genuinely drawn to arrangements and orchestration, not just power chords. The Rumor could match Parker's Fury because they had been trained by years of pub rock to play urgently and precisely at the same time. The E Street Band members on Hunter's album brought a cinematic emotional scope that matched Hunter's ambitions perfectly. In each case, the backing band was not interchangeable. It was not a collection of competent session musicians who could have been replaced by other competent session musicians. It was the precise, unrepeatable configuration that made this specific art possible. The right musicians at the right moment in the service of the right songs. And what makes it moving, I think, is that the most musicians accepted a kind of creative anonymity in exchange for the privilege of being part of something great. They played on records that people still listen to 50 years later. They played in rooms where the music was so alive that the hair stood up on everyone's arms. They didn't always get their name in lights or even on the album cover, but they were there, and what they played was permanent. That is not nothing. In many ways, that is everything. In conclusion, the story of the great backing bands of the 60s and 70s is ultimately a story about how collective intelligence, the intelligence of musicians who know how to listen to each other and the frontman they serve, can produce art of a scale and permanence that no individual genius working alone could have ever achieved.
Mr. Mick, as we wind up this episode, can you connect the dots between music and business?
I think it's appropriate to make that type of connection. Every era has its myths of the lone genius, the solitary figure at the microphone, the master guitarist alone in the spotlight, the songwriter who changed the world one chord at a time. But rock and roll, at its most elemental, is, of course, a team sport. This episode of Music 101 pulls back the curtain on that hidden architecture, those famous bands who had raw talent, something lasting and almost impossibly great. You can hear it in the way Bob Dylan sharpened when he aligned the band, not just amplified, but clarified. The songs didn't merely get louder. They got deeper, more grounded, more human. Or consider how Elvis Presley, for all his charisma, depended on tight, disciplined musicianship to translate instinct into something repeatable night after night. Even the loose brilliance of the Rolling Stones rested on an internal chemistry that was anything but accidental. That's the first lesson for business. Talent may open the door, but cohesion builds the house. A founder, like a frontman, can carry vision and voice, but without a backing structure that interprets, challenges, and refines that vision, the result rarely holds up under pressure. In music, the difference between a rehearsal and a legendary recording often comes down to whether the band is merely competent or truly locked in. In business, the same principle applies. A group of individually impressive people is not yet a team. Alignment, musical or organizational, is something forged through friction, trust, and shared standards. There's an old truth that echoes from both the studio and scripture. Where there is no counsel, plans fail, but with many advisors, they succeed. The best bands understood this intuitively. They argued, experimented, pushed back, and in doing so, prevented the kind of thin thinking that collapses under real scrutiny. The same is true in a company worth building. If everyone is simply echoing the leader, you don't have harmony. You have noise dressed up as agreement. And then there's restraint, the discipline to play the right note instead of every note. Listen closely to the great records of that era, and you'll notice something that's almost paradoxical. What's not played matters as much as what is. The bassist who holds back, the drummer who leaves space, the keyboardist who chooses texture over dominance. These are decisions that elevate the whole. In business, the strongest teams operate with that same awareness. Not every voice needs to lead at once. Not every idea needs to be pursued. Clarity often emerges from subtraction, not addition. In the end, the myth of the lone genius is comforting, but it's also misleading. Whether on stage or in the marketplace, enduring impact is almost always a result of a group that's learned how to listen as well as perform, how to support without disappearing, and how to lead without overpowering. In conclusion, the spotlight may fall on one name, but the sound, the thing that lasts, is always a shared creation.
Very well said, Mr. Meg. Journey back to Rack's golden era and discover the extraordinary musicians whose powerful rhythms, unforgettable harmonies, and creative brilliance helped transform legendary performance into a timeless recordings. This episode celebrates the backing bands whose artistry often remained outside the spotlight but becomes essential to the sound, energy, and enduring legacy of rock music. Mr. Mick, would you like to plug in something?
Thanks for the opportunity. Write the book, Grow the Business. Connect with me on LinkedIn. G. Mick, the Doctor of Digital Smith, PhD. Listen to the Doctor of Digital podcast. Pick up a couple volumes I have on Amazon, On Track, Ian Hunter, and Burning America. And if you like music, listen and report and support True Fans.
Yes, people, let's support Mr. Mick, the Doctor Digital, and of course, our four podcasts that we're doing each week, Music 101, Sex 101, Mental Health 101, as well as Love Letters. And please do visit our official website, www.universalpodcast.net, where you can see all the podcasts that we are creating. Yes, so Mr. Mick, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, my friend. Till next time, Deus Vault.
Welcome, people. See you soon.
Thank you for joining us on the Universal Podcast Network. One voice, everywhere.